Reminder, participants, this conference is being recorded. If you have objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thanks a lot. This is Mikey. Roberto is on the call. Welcome to today's vertical integration call. We've got a fairly straightforward agenda today. Most of the time is going to be devoted to essentially a wide-ranging discussion of the various proposals. And so for the very first thing on the call, I'd like to get a list of those people who have proposals who would like to speak. And you can just raise your hand in the Adobe Connect. And if you're not on Adobe Connect, you can just speak right up. So let's get that list. The thought I had was that today is sort of the transitional moment where we switch between proposals running in parallel to proposals that we are comparing. One of the things that came up on the list was that people are having a hard time sort of figuring out what's in the various proposals. And I think that I share that view. It's hard to compare them. And so as people are talking about their proposals today, one of the things I think we ought to do is try and come up with sort of what do proposals have to say about various and sundry things. For example,
Mikey, if we can interrupt, everyone is hearing quite a bad echo on you when you're speaking.
Yeah, I'm hearing it too. I'm just ignoring it. Is it only my line that's echoing?
It's several lines.
Okay. Is there something we should do?
I'm trying to locate the exact line, but it looks like it's bouncing off of several lines.
Okay.
What I suggest is we're going to mute quite a few of the lines until you finish talking, Mikey.
Okay, that's fine. And then can people unmute themselves if you've muted them?
They can press star 6 to mute and star 6 again to unmute.
Okay, so if we mute them and you find that you are on mute, dial star 6 and you will get unmuted. That's the trouble with this many people on the call. It's just hard. So anyway, as people are talking about proposals, I think it would be useful to start describing the features of proposals. What are things that we can use to compare them? And what we'll start doing is building a matrix that's basically all these features down the side, and as best we can, we'll fill in what each proposal has to say about that thing, and we'll get a draft of that done hopefully by next week's call. So as you're talking about your proposal, just mention the features that are in it.
Mikey, this is Scott Austin. Sorry to interrupt. Did you do roll call already?
No, I'm sort of killing a little time because we're getting folks still joining the call. But
just want to let you know. Thanks.
Yeah, we're going to do a roll call in just a second. Thanks, Scott. So anyway, that's sort of the plan for the day. Most of the conversation about proposals and the features thereof. A little conversation at the end about the evaluation group. I got a fair amount of conversation about that off list, and so I want to spend just a tiny bit of time clarifying what we're expecting that group to do, and then most of that time brainstorming, again, to give them sort of a starting point for their first task, which is to come up with a list of evaluation criteria. And that's it, unless there's something really urgent to go into any other business. So I'll pause for a second.
Mikey, this is Tim.
Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, just, and I have to apologize again. I'm still trying to get caught up on all of the traffic. I'm just wondering, is there a description of what the review team's work product is supposed to be, or how they're going to
Yes, there is in a sketchy form, which I'll run through again. I sent a little slide deck to the list before last week's call, and we'll bring that back up again when we get to that part of the agenda. Because the review team is misnamed. I purposely named it evaluation, not evaluators, because eventually we, the working group, are the evaluators. But we need to have some heavy lifting done. We need some essentially staff work done before moving into that phase. And rather than load the staff up with all of that, I thought it would be useful to form another group of people just to come up with a first, essentially a first draft of these criteria, so that then we, the group, can tune them up and begin applying them. But this is not a group that's been given the job of evaluating the proposals, but rather coming up with the way that we'll evaluate them. And I'll spend a little more time on that in 15 minutes at the end. I haven't heard anything about the agenda not being right, so let's do the roll call with the folks that we've got on the call now, and then we'll move into the actual proposal discussion. Gisela, you want to do the roll call?
Absolutely. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. I do apologize ahead of the call for any mispronunciation of the names. On today's call, we have Stephen Mutasami, Mike O'Connor, Faisal Shah, Ruslan Sattarov, George Sadovsky, Paul Diaz, Steve Pinkos, Sebastian Bachelet, Ashley Jagathesan, Barry Cobb, Ron Andruff, Jeff Eckhouse, Kathy Kleinman, Roberto Gaetano, David Maher, Nacho Amados, Phil Buckingham, Alan Greenberg, Jotham Frakes, Tara Muscala, Michael Palage, Catherine Olner, Jean-Christophe Vigne, Anthony Harris, Christina Rosette, Avery Doria, Volker Greimann, Graham Chinwith, Scott Austin, Tim Ruiz, Brian Cute, Jaco Ruska, Eric Brunner-Williams, Richard Sindel, Keith Drazek. From staff, we have Glenda Sangeri, Margie Milam, Mike Zupka, Liz Gaster, Dan Holleran, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. I hope I haven't left anyone off. And
did anybody did anybody not hear their name called and want to speak up for the roll call? Okay. We're keeping track of it through MeetingView, and if people come on after roll call, we'll include them in the attendees. I see two people with their hand raised to speak about their proposals. Are there others who would like to indicate that they would like a slot? Basically, what I've got is 60 minutes, and we'll divide it by the number of people who want to speak and go. So if you would like to talk about your proposal, this is the time to indicate that. And if we don't have more than two, then we'll split it between the two of them. Going once, going twice. Done. Why don't we... Oh, Aubrey's in. Any of the Jeffs want to talk about your proposals? Okay. Why don't we take about 15 minutes for the three folks who have indicated that they'd like to speak, and that gives us another 15 minutes for late bloomers. So we'll try to wrap all this up by about 10 after the hour from now. Phil Buckingham hasn't presented his proposal before, so he gets the honors to lead us off. And
all right.
Take it away,
yep.
Phil.
Hello, everybody. Yep, my name's Phil Buckingham. I'm in sunny London today. And as I say, I haven't put my proposal forward this morning. You've got it on the screen there. So basically what... I'll just basically read it out, and you can read along with it. It's got no slides, nothing else. And I guess it's going to take me about 5 minutes to read it through. Okay, so I'll just start slowly and hopefully you can all hear me. So here we go, son. So it's a vertical integration proposal, total separation or total integration or somewhere in between. It's a from the perspective of a new GTLD applicant. So I'm posing a question, the first question, and it will basically, I'll play the devil's advocate, and I'm a member of the ICANN board, and I'm basically posing the question, you know, what questions would I be looking to ask and be satisfied with to accept a proposal or proposals from this working group? So I wanted to, obviously I've been looking at all the emails and all the comments, fantastic comments from everybody, very detailed, and I thought to myself, I wanted to step back a little bit and sort of look at the bigger picture, the background behind what's going on here, why we're all here, and then put it into the context of a VI and a proposal. So basically, you're going to scroll down here, please, so everybody can read.
Everybody can control the screen themselves.
Yeah,
so
they're okay then. So
yep.
I need to control mine then. Okay. So the bigger picture. One, ICANN has obviously announced that if this working group does not come up with a proposal or proposals, then it will default to the existing status quo, which was basically set up about 10 years ago. I mean, that's pretty obvious. And within that context, we had a .coms.org.net, and basically, in my book, they control, whatever that means, 70 to 80% of the GTLD market. I mean, 70 to 80% is a sort of a guesstimate. And likewise, GoDaddy is a top registrar and is registered 70% of registrations today. Okay? So therefore, in my book, the market is open potentially to price fixing, and it's not in the interest of the end user. Secondly, ICANN has a remit to open up the GTLD space to significant competition, innovation, consumer choice, accessible to everybody globally. And its very existence could be dependent on the success or failure of new GTLDs. I mean, I'm sure you've all got your various comments on this, but this is the way my assessment of the situation. ICANN wants and needs more applications rather than less to cover its huge implementation costs. Number four, application numbers are unknown. The global market demand has still not been established. New GTLDs could be a success or they could be an abject failure. The marketplace will be totally different to the current market, and the current rules surrounding VS need to change to one of VI. Number seven, as I said here, in capital letters, but critically, how far across the spectrum do we need to go with this? Number eight, ICANN needs innovators, entrepreneurs to apply finance and take the associated risk of a new application. To be honest with you, some of you know, I'm one of those people. And I've put in brackets, so I'm excluding corporate DOPRA brands here at the moment. Number nine, business models must stack up. The market demand established that's got to be established is within its own new GTLD. And I've put in notes, Benny, so it has no impact from other new GTLDs. Number 10, new GTLDs will sink or swim based on their market demand. Number 11, there's a very arduous and very expensive application process. And number 12, the whole DNS, in my book, that's all of us, it's going to get bigger, and potentially there's all opportunities for all of us, whether we're registrars, registries, whatever we are, within this whole community. So each new application in my book, whether it be a city one, a cultural one, a brand one, a course, whatever it is, it needs to be given the tools and the ability to craft its business model in the widest context in terms of vertical integration. So then I've gone on. So each one of us in this working group that's here is here for a reason. Some are working for registries, some are working for registrars, some are representing dot brands, potential dot brands, some potential dot cities, some are outsiders, some are policy experts, etc. So So basically, we have a whole range of very clever, very impressive people in my book. So we need each to ask ourselves, if we have had a full VI, what are the issues? If we have a full VI, what are the issues and the consequences to our business and our business interests with the arrival of new GTLDs? And likewise, if we had a partial integration, what would the impact be? And if we stay with the total separation as it stands at the moment, what's the situation there? What's right with it and what is wrong with it? And number four, can we find a compromise solution of partial integration? And number five, should we go for a total solution that covers all eventualities, all scenarios, which would obviously be a full VI? So then I've come up, this is my solution, the way I look at it. Number one, set up teams to represent different types of known and unknown applications using the full spectrum of knowledge levels available to us. And obviously that's people from inside the community, outside the community. And then each one of us answer questions about ourselves to get the right team mix. Then number three, put together what-if questions that if your assigned application would like to do but currently cannot presently do in the context of separation. So I put in a question here. Obviously, I'm behind the Dot Royal application. So I'm saying to myself here, one simple question. I want to only use one registrar. Is that possible? And what role is stopping that? And then ask that same question. Then ask, would that be in the interests of new registrars, old registrars, everybody that's in the value chain? So obviously from that, you create a new rule that will allow this to happen or not happen. And then I've said number four, teams or evaluations or evaluators, whatever you want to call them, to look at these new rules. And then in terms of, and I've written down here six, seven things, and obviously there's many more that we need to discuss, and I've put it at pricing, antitrust, transfer pricing issues, compliance issues, gaming, implementation issues, level of consensus, how this rule is to be applied to other applications, and then I've put down the bottom, obviously please add to that list. And then I've said we need to set up some general rules or general assumptions, like to me there's got to be a level playing field across everybody, so it's a level playing field. And then I've said, you know, if a registry sells names only internally, it does not require a registrar. So those kind of, you know, these are just examples, and maybe you disagree with them, whatever, but they're just examples. So then I've concluded and said, we have to look at all scenarios in the context of VS and VI to cover all bases. And then I've asked questions. Will we be able to achieve a total solution within the time constraints? Will we be able to get a consensus? Because to me, it's what does that mean? What is consensus within this community of 70-odd people? And then by making these VI options as wide as possible, to me, it will allow and convince all undecided applicants that an application to ICANN is in their business interests and within their own particular mission statement. And then what I put down the bottom is, what I don't want to do is spend a huge amount of work only, to be honest with you, to see it being rejected by the board, which in my book could potentially delay the whole process, which I don't want to happen. So that's just my ideas, and I'm sure you can all of you can pick it to bits, and I'm happy to take the criticism if that's right. Okay?
Thanks, Bill. I've got Kathy and Avery in the queue to speak about their proposals, so everybody can put their hands down, and then we'll just manage the queue of questions for Phil. So you have a question for Phil? This is the time to ask. There's Richard Tyndall. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, guys. So, Phil, a quick question for you. I think you said that your proposal is to have one, for Dot Royal, is to have one registrar. I assume that that means that the registry...
I was just using the example and saying, you know, that's one of my ideas. Can I do that within the context of what we're talking about here? So that's, you know, is that possible? Is it not possible? And from my point of view, I would, as the way I'm trying to put my business model together, you know, I would like that to happen. I would like to, you know, that be available to me.
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought you were proposing that, but it's just a sort of question.
No, it's a question. It's a question. I'm saying, you know, possibly there's another applicant out there that would like to do exactly the same thing, and whether that is a good idea in terms of virtual integration or not.
Okay, understand.
And whether it's possible to do it.
To answer that question, I think in the context of the current rules, it would not be permissible to...
No, exactly. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, I would like to do that. I would like to do that. And is it possible to change the rules to do that?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, all rules are possible to be changed. I think it's important probably to differentiate between the cross-ownership rules that we're talking about now and the equivalent access rule for registrars, which is really quite a separate concept. There's the concept of whether or not you have to use all registrars, which is kind of recommendation 19 of the GNSO implementation. That's one issue, and then a separate, somewhat related, but separate issue is the registry itself allowed to own a piece or, in fact, all of one of those registrars?
Yep. Okay.
Phil?
So do you not think it would be a good idea? We've raised one particular question there, and I've got a very good answer. So that we should have a poll and say, you know, in that context, is that a good idea? Should we say yes or no to that? Because, I don't know all these rules, this 19 rule, but to me, you know, that's what it stands at the moment. That's the way it is at the moment. And I'm saying, well, I'd like to get rid of that rule, that 19 rule, and allow me to do this way.
Phil, this is Mikey. I'm going to barge in. You're out of time.
All right. Okay.
Avery had her hand up, and I wasn't sure. Avery, were you going to ask Phil a question, or were you just putting your hand back up to be in?
I was going to make a quick comment about Phil's, but I can do that at some other point if that's not now.
Go ahead, especially
okay,
if it's quick. We're not that tight.
Had to do with the thing of we wouldn't want the board to throw away the work of this group, or, you know, we wouldn't want to waste our time. I think if this group does its work well, has consensus, gets passed on by the GNSO Council for having done its work well with diligence and diversity, I from past history, I just don't see that being the likely result. That's all.
Thanks, Aubrey. Okay, Phil, thanks very much for your proposal. And we'll move on to Kathy, who's got the next 15 minutes. So you have until 20 minutes to the hour.
Okay, thank you, Mikey. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Excellent. I always want to double check when we come off mute. Hello, everybody. I am not going to repeat the whole proposal. And I'm not going to use most of my time. Everybody knows the main proposal here, which is that we have a main model and three exceptions. The main model is full structural separation of registries and registrars, sticking with the 15% ownership by a registry of any ICANN-accredited registrar, whether or not it's in the same TLD that the registry is distributing. And really looking for a separation that is... a separation of registries and registrars in that equal access, that equal treatment that's easily verifiable and auditable. And then the three exceptions, the single registrant GTLD, whatever the details of that may come from this working group, the community GTLD and the orphan GTLD, and allowing all of these groups some amount of time to grow, but after they grow enough, then they feed back into the system of the ICANN-accredited registrars. And a lot of the details here are subject. I've been in a lot of working groups, as we all know, as have all of us. And a lot of the details here are subject to negotiation. We needed a starting point, so I put it forth. But what I really want to comment on is what's our goal here? What are we really trying to accomplish? And I wanted to suggest that our goal, and I don't hear much discussion about it, but our goal is really registrants and how to get a diversity of new GTLDs into the hands of registrants. And don't forget, until a few weeks ago, I spent 10 years, a decade, on the registrant side of ICANN. And so I don't forget that overnight. And the idea that we really want this profusion of offerings to go to registrants, which leads to the next question, which is, what's the best way to get new GTLDs to registrants? And I'm going to throw out here that the ICANN-accredited registrar base is a proven model for successfully getting GTLDs out to registrants all over the world. We have big registrars and small registrars, and what I love is the profusion of registrars in developing countries around the world that are really working on reaching out to their communities. And I think with the IDNs, this will grow. With the new GTLDs and the community GTLDs, this will grow, this ability to reach registrants and serve them with domain names they can use and want to use all over the world. So how do we then best serve this base of the ICANN-accredited registrars? And it was interesting. I was making a chart across all the proposals, and there's one principle that goes across all proposals, actually, strangely enough, with the exception of ours, where there's a tweak on it. But that's the equal access. It's the recommendation 19 from the GNSO, this equal access that all registrars should have the same access to information, the same technical access to the drops and to the data. That this equal access provision is a common denominator because it fosters the system of the ICANN-accredited registrars, which then distributes domain names around the world to registrants. If we want to keep the equal access, then we have to look at proposals carefully, because ccTLDs have no equal access provision. They can use the information. They can give the information selectively to registrars, ICANN-accredited or not. But we have a provision of this equal access, and if we're going to put it in, if we're going to preserve it, if we're going to preserve our existing model, then I say you have to really think about the proposals that have the ability to ensure that the system works, the ICANN-accredited registrar system works. And structural separation and separation of control are these are proven ways of preserving that equal access in a way that is verifiable and auditable and workable. And it's also a separation of structures, a separation of purposes. So I posit that the PIR proposal serves this well, as do some of the other proposals, and that this is an important principle in our discussion and why and what the ultimate goal is that I think we're trying to serve. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. We've got another 10 minutes about to pose questions or expand on that. I do want to highlight one thing. Any and all of you who are, as Kathy has mentioned, doing charts, comparing the proposals, I'd love a copy of them, because I really think that's our next step, is to put together a chart that we can use to compare the proposals, let proposal advocates fill in the parts that their proposals don't address, so that we can move pretty quickly to a pretty comprehensive single-page kind of document that we can use to see where these proposals agree and where they disagree. And with that, anybody want to pose a question to Kathy in the next few minutes? Jeffrey.
Yeah, thanks. Kathy, I agree with you on a lot of those points, and I just have a question for you regarding, I guess, the community and the other ones. Is Well, I guess what I'm trying to figure out, and I guess this is maybe not only for your proposal, but a few of the other proposals that I'm still trying to wrap my head around, why is there, I guess, concern or suddenly fear kicks in of what's going to happen at, like, domain name number 50,001 or, you know, on the community or the other ones? I'm just trying to get, like, why is that? You know, if it's a concern that, you know, as I can tell from, we need to keep this separation because there'll be data commingling and bad things will happen. So why is that not a concern when there's 50,000 and up to those numbers? I'm just trying to wrap my head. And I know you had this and a few others had this in their proposal. So I guess it's maybe to all the people that have that number or, you know, and the same thing actually goes for that. And I've asked this before, like that 15% number, I know it's a legacy number. So why is that number there? Is it just because, hey, it's been in there and, you know, nothing's gone wrong, so let's just keep that number? I'm just trying to get my head around the number. So as we try and move forward towards, you know, negotiations or to figure things out, to try, what's why we have those numbers? So hopefully maybe you can shed some light on that.
I can certainly try. Thanks for the question, but I also invite others who have submitted proposals with this issue in them to respond as well, and you're welcome to take some of my time on that. The 50,000 is not a legacy number. This is a new concept. It's been floated around in various proposals for a while, and the idea is trying to draw a line, whether it's the right line or not, whether this is the right place or not, trying to draw a line between when a GTLD when the GTLD is really small, is really isolated, and when it should be, when it's big enough to open up to a general system. That's at least what I'm trying to achieve in our proposal. Is, you know, when have you made the case that there's probably a much bigger market and that registrars will pick this up and distribute it around the world? And so that's what we're trying to aim at with the 50,000. And also, there was a lot of talk. I mean, we had a week of discussions about single registrant GTLDs and all the gaming that's possible, and when is it not appropriate, and when is it appropriate to be a single registrant GTLD, and lots of borderline cases. So, trying to create something cut and dry. Once you hit a certain number X, whatever X is, then you open up to equal access to all ICANN accredited registrars. In the main model, the 15% ownership is a legacy number, but it's a number that works. It's a number empirically that has worked well. It is a number that we see reflected in various entities today, registration entities, and not PIR, but others. And it seems to it's a small percentage of ownership. Now, in certain circumstances, it could be a controlling ownership. If you have a public company with very diversely held shares, 15% could actually be controlling or close to controlling, which is why we've superimposed the full structural separation. And I think that's where the PIR proposal differs from some of the others, is that it's both separation of control and full separation of financial and other types of structural controls.
So can I just follow up? Mikey, one quick question on that? So now I'm just trying to get the clarification. So for you guys, for the PIR proposal, the structural control is more – separation is more important than, say, control and the ownership?
No, both. Both, because both create something verifiable and clear. So you can verify 15% ownership of a registry and a registrar. You can verify that. And full structural separation, we're talking about full operational separation, full financial separation, full separation of control. You don't have overlapping staffs. You don't have overlapping data centers. You don't have overlapping development, software development people. And that is also something verifiable. So when it comes to those equal access provisions, you know, has data been passing intentionally or inadvertently between registry and registrar? You can say no. There's a full separation there.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I was going to call on Alan, but he took his hand down. Richard, you're next.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi, Richard.
So PIR proposal
We have a strict 15% cross-ownership prohibition regardless of the TLD in question. And so
that is what we are proposing.
Yeah. So I wanted to explore your reasoning for that and just to illustrate it for everyone's benefit. So what you're saying is that, say, Newstar, who's the registry for .biz at the moment, you're saying that they couldn't own more than 15% in a registrar that only sold .com. Or, for example, you're saying that Enom, the registrar, couldn't own more than 15% of a registry, even if, as a registrar, they didn't sell that TLD. So you've sort of encompassed all TLDs, regardless whether the cross-owned registrar combination is selling that name. So given the reasons that you provided for you know, the harms that you've provided when you cross the 15% threshold, it seems to me all those harms apply to the specific TLD in question. So I'm wondering why you've carved out a sort of a bigger amount of area here that says, no, you can't own 15% of any TLD.
It's a good question. And everything here is subject to the discussions of the group, but it makes sense once to have a rule. First, what we're doing is embracing the rule as it exists today, which is that a registry can own 15% of any ICANN-accredited registrar, regardless of the distribution. So, again, embracing the system that worked, the system that protects the registry-registrar separation. And if we're going to change that, I think we should have some really good reasons to do it, and those reasons may well exist within the working group.
Okay. I agree with you. That's what the current contract say, although I'm not sure that was intention of them, but I agree with you. That's what they say. So I agree with you. I think it would be worthwhile exploring. You know, for example, I could not see any harm Newstar being a registrar in .com while they're the registry for .biz. I don't see any of the perceived harms kicking in there.
The problem I see is when they decide they want to offer, when they decide they want to expand. I can see that being a problem because then they'll come and ask for an exception. You know, now I want to circulate my TLD, my own TLD.
This is Mikey. We're at the end of the time, but we have a little extra time. So with the permission of the group, I'd like to let Kathy's slot go another 5 minutes. And with that, call on Scott.
Thanks, Mikey. I don't want to beat this to death because we've talked about 15% before, but the question I have, and it was raised by the last person in a sense, 15% to me doesn't keep the owner from having knowledge of the workings of the entity that he owns. In other words, even if you have 1% or maybe 0.1%, it seems to me you would still have the right to have disclosure of information. I mean, at least that's if we're using a stock context, for example. Most of the laws in the United States, and I'll be parochial here if I have to be, require any shareholder to have certain rights of information. So I guess my question is, if it's a control issue, what is the harm that's the concern at the 15%? Or I guess if it's an accrued 15%, are we concerned about one particular registrar or registry, because it sounds like it goes both ways, it's a two-way street, having accruing a total of more than 15% in various registries of new TLDs?
Scott, I'm sorry, I'm going to disagree with you on the premise of what you've said. I own stock in lots of companies, small amounts, not worth very much. But I don't get much information about how that company is run, and I certainly don't get any confidential information from those companies.
Well, you have a right to lots of information under the Securities and Exchange Commission rules.
Well, maybe Jeff Newman, who's public. We're a nonprofit, a 501c3. PIR is, but maybe Jeff Newman can address this. But when we're talking about the kind of equal access data that's involved, and I listed out, we're talking about information that I could be wrong. I don't think it's just available to any stockholder. And we're also talking about technical connections. We're talking about software updates and patches and customer support. Equivalent access stretches across stretches beyond EPP data, and again, I question its accessibility.
But does that change at 15%? That's what I'm trying to get at.
There's certainly situations at 15% where, again, what I said a few minutes ago, where you could have a controlling interest. Hence, we offer the structural separation above and beyond the 15%. But if you go beyond 15%, where's your cutoff then? 40%, 50%, 60%. Now you're really moving into actual controlling interest, and then you would have that kind of right to information and much more of a likelihood that you'd be accessing it or having some kind of access to it one way or the other.
I'm going to crash in here just in the interest of staying on schedule. Scott, one last really quick follow-up, and then on to Alan.
Yeah, my only comment is that I just don't see 15% as a bright-line test in terms of access to confidential information. You might not even have that at 49%.
Scott, can I ask, where would you put the line?
Well, I think we're asking the wrong question. That's my whole premise is I think we're asking the wrong question. And I like Phil's approach, by the way, in the sense that he went back to what will the auditors be asking in terms of a standard. I think that's the real key. And I'll end with that.
Thanks, Scott. Alan, you're next. And it's going to have to be pretty crisp because we're getting close to the time.
It will be pretty crisp. I think one of the last comments was right, but not in the way it was meant. I think that we are asking the wrong questions in some cases, and I think questions about why is 15% the magic number or why 50% is the magic number are the wrong questions. I like the overall concept and philosophy of the proposal that PRR has made because I think it addresses the things that are important. We have a model that basically works today, that's been reasonably successful. And I think what this group needs to do, what ICANN needs to do, is say, how do we need to change this proposal so that in light of new GTLDs, the public interest is protected, and we don't set up processes and rules which will guarantee failure of large numbers or specific classes of new GTLDs. And I think that's what we should be focusing on, not necessarily how do we open the market to a completely different model when that's not the issue that we need to address in a timely manner today. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree completely with Alan, and I thought it was phrased wonderfully, and that's the right question. And I'll just add in closing that there are 945 registrars right now, ICANN accredited registrars. Thank you. And thanks for the time, everybody, in the discussion.
This is Blage. Can I?
Michael, hang on. Do you want to jump in as a proposal presenter? Is that what you're in for? If not,
no, I was going to let Avery go. And but what I'll do is I'll just have a follow-up question to Kathy during our session.
Okay. Avery, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks. And I doubt that I'll use the whole 15. And I invite Mike to jump in on my talking anytime he feels the need to do so. So I really only want to cover two things. One is sort of how we're working our proposal, and then two, a little bit about the changes on the amended proposal or revised proposal that was sent in during the week. So what we've been doing is after the meetings, we basically take everything that's been said in the mailing list and in the meetings, look at our proposal and try to come to consensus on how we would try to respond to those issues, even if those issues hadn't been presented specifically against the proposal we put there. So the process that we've put ourselves into, for example, we've already started talking about, I think it was Richard's proposal, on different ways to look at the single registrant with the single user and the multiple user variations and how to handle that. We haven't come to our own little MMA consensus on it yet, and sometimes it does look like that cage. But, you know, in the meantime, we basically take all these things and see. So that's where the revision comes from. So the revision that was put out last week basically was looking at a couple of the issues. For example, various issues had come up with a whole notion of a percentage-based threshold for sending things on why that percentage. Was it an appropriate percentage? Is control sufficient, or do we need to take in structure in doing this? And so 10% became something that was obviously problematic to many, and so we looked at that. We looked at the problem that people brought up. This was specific to our proposal and to competition authorities, of having to give off a business case first in terms of predictability and equal chance. And basically, so how do you deal with that? No one wants to put out their business case for this before the starting bell. So how do you deal with that issue? There was also the issue of ICANN with 40% thresholds for market share definitions and such, and for deciding which and when something gets sent, being in the position of making competition decisions on its own, which was again seen by many people as problematic, that ICANN itself should be making that kind of criteria. And what information would be needed by a competition authority. So basically that sort of pushed ahead, the changes. And the change basically consists of including in the application a proposed set of questions that would define distribution model, including things like registrar, are you going direct, are you doing some hybrid, what kind of arrangements are there about control, and structure, et cetera, co-ownership, what have you, that those things, and the name of the TLD and its, community aspect or whatever, and that's obviously something that needs to be defined as what are all those things that one answers questions of, but they answer them in their application. Then any of those that are going to multiple control or a structure that has more than one registrar or registry would be sent off to the competition authorities for evaluation. And it may even be sent off, and I don't know that we've got that included in there, but this came out in some of our discussions, could be sent off to several appropriate competition authorities, depending upon, obviously where ICANN is located, where the registry is located, is in a country that also has a regional authority. Now, one of the questions that people have come up with is, do we know whether the competition authorities are going to accept these and act on them in our time frames? And that's being checked informally in the background, as I said on the list. But yes, if we start to have a solution that requires, competition authorities to interact with us, we do need to take the step as a working group to more formally establish that. So, and then the other thing we added is we realized that when we were in this, we sort of had a default for what happens if they, don't have a negative answer, but we never had something that sort of said, if the competition authority comes out and with a flag up saying, yes, we have a problem here, we need to indicate that, of course, ICANN doesn't go forward with the application until that flag comes down. So I don't know if Michael has anything to add to what I went over, and certainly would want to open it up to questions.
No, nothing further to add on that, Aubrey. Thanks. So I guess we'll just take questions from anyone from the list group.
Yep, that's the plan. At least tentatively, we'll try to wrap this section up right at the top of the hour. If it gets going again, we've got a little flexibility. We can run a little over that. But if people have questions, this is the time.
Mike, you said you had a follow-up question for Kathy. This might be a time.
Yeah, I guess one of the things, Kathy, when you were talking about how the PIR proposal would help with IDNs in developing countries. I guess what I struggle with is out of those 900 plus ICANN accredited registrars, how many of them are from the developing region? I think there's only, last time I checked, a single digits, if not one or two, in South America, single digits in Africa. So I guess that's kind of what I struggle with, and one of the things that we tried to do with our proposal is to provide the cultural or linguistic TLD operator to have that flexibility to go outside and perhaps go direct. So that's one of the, I think, positives that Milton, Avery, and myself sort of saw in our proposal when we were developing it. And perhaps you could maybe contrast PIR's proposal to what we're proposing and how that would play out in developing countries.
Well, actually, since it's your time, can I ask you to do that comparison? Because
sure.
We've got the defined exceptions that would work precisely for small registries coming in who can show that they're orphans, that there's really no one picking up that distribution, or the community DTLD. This is set up, this comes, you know, these concepts, not the community DTLD, but the orphan DTLD comes straight out of NCUC and its debate on this issue back in Seoul. That real concern and need for developing countries and distribution to their register.
So I guess my concern, I'm not opposed to the orphan concept, and Avery and Milton and I talked about perhaps including that as one of the exceptions. Our concern, however, is with the orphan, the TLD almost has to be on life support before you give – you have to be orphaned before you have the business flexibility to try to be successful. So I guess from our standpoint, we'd like to give the registry the opportunity from day one to compete in the marketplace, innovate, provide new choice to consumers, as opposed to say you need to be on your last dying breath, essentially be orphaned, and then we'll give you the flexibility. We think that that's somewhat suspect. With regard to just following up on TLDs, and let's look at .cat. Eric Nacho, I think, is on the call. But there are 900, as you say, 940 ICANN-accredited registrars. Now, out of those 940, only 20 have signed up with .cat to provide domain name registration services. And out of those 20, three account for 80%. So, again, that's just a small one. Now, fortunately...
Wait, but doesn't that show the counter to your point? .cat is perfectly successful working through the ICANN-accredited registrar process. Even if they don't have all 945, they've got enough to be successful in their own book, and they're not asking for any exceptions.
I would tend to disagree with that. What happens is they started off with 30. They're now at, I believe, 40,000 names. Now, again, that is, if you look at the Catalan people, that is primarily in Europe where there is a large install base. What happens if you go to, say, South Africa? I believe Jonathan Frakes is on the call, and I think Minds and Machines is talking about doing a .Zulu. How many ICANN-accredited registrars are there to provide choice and innovation to those people that might want to register .Zulu?
Sounds like a community DTLD to me. And just to correct something, because Milton raised it too, you don't have to be dying to qualify for the orphan DTLD. You don't have to be dead. You don't have to have exhausted your financial. It's a pre-launch certification. So it's before launch.
So what happens
you
is
don't
it's
have
a pre-launch.
But it's to prevent gaming. It's to prevent someone raising their hand and saying, you know, .buzz, that they're prescribing themselves, that they're proclaiming themselves to be orphan, when in reality they're not.
So what happens, Kathy, the problem is you want to talk about gaming. So now there's a pre-launch certification, which means ICANN staff, in addition to processing hundreds of applications as they're working their way through, are now going to have to do another subsequent verification. The beauty, and this is one of the reasons why in the joint proposal we took ICANN out of it. Let's acknowledge the fact. It's a technical coordinating body. It's not a competition authority. There are people that paid good money that are professionals that work for national governments that make these determinations on a regular basis. Let them make this decision.
Hey, don't you
sitting
have
there,
ICANN getting involved in all sorts of – ICANN's what summons the competition authorities, right? So in your – in your proposal, at least as I read it, and help me out, ICANN is summoned many, many more times than...
No, they're just referring... No, all ICANN does is it packages the information and it gives it to the experts to make the determination. That's what it does. ICANN makes no determination of market share, nothing. It packages it up and it sends it. And in fact, just the U.S. Department of Justice, looking at from a scalability standpoint of whether they could handle these volumes, the DOJ just last year came up with a new hotline in which almost anyone could submit a potential inquiry to DOJ to look for antitrust concerns. So the ability, again, we're looking at this from a broad international perspective, not just U.S.-centric, but the people I know are more familiar with U.S. law, but at least from a U.S. standpoint, what's being proposed is not is viable, is the simple answer. So if we can allow competition authorities to do their job and let ICANN to focus on its job, which is technical coordination, that's the, I guess that's the end goal. And again, it goes back to, you know, our initial comment that we discussed, I think, last week. Competition happened in com. GoDaddy, Enom resulted in NSI going from 100% market share to like 30% market share in 3 to 5 years. Yeah.
Michael, this is Mikey. I'm just pointing out that you're nearly at the end of the time and you've got a little queue building up.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay. Jeffrey, you're up first.
Thanks. Actually, thanks. If I can switch gears, and this is a question to the M&A are on the call today, and it's just a question on your proposal. And I guess part of the proposal was, you know, described, you know, audit checks and you know, the strict penalties and those sorts of things immediately. Going on to the TLD, you know, just right away that's part of their infrastructure. Do you think, I'm just a question, do you think that it is worth exploring, or did you explore doing something where it would be maybe just a complaint driven up until a certain size, you know, that's predetermined, like up until 100,000 domains or whatever that a certain number is. So up until there, those audits or other things wouldn't be required to keep the cost down for these new TLDs. Or it's a thought in my head versus saying, you know, because it's saying, hey, you're sort of innocent until proven guilty, until somebody complains or makes an issue of it. Have you thought about that versus automatically starting off that way?
So, Avery, do you want to take this or I can
go? Yeah, I can start. I don't actually think we thought about it. It definitely is an interesting idea. I think that there's two things to be thought of. One is the self-audit infrastructure, and the other is the yearly audit by someone properly designated. I tend to look at it in terms of its parallels to an accounting audit. So I don't tend to see it as being that big a deal for a small entity, but I would certainly consider that kind of complaint-driven thing within certain, you know, bounds, and perhaps still with yearly or bi-yearly type of audits. But I certainly wouldn't disclose it, but we didn't talk about it to my recollection.
This is Mikey. I'm going to jump in here. You're right at the end of your time. I'm going to do the same thing and give you 5 more minutes, but you've got 2 more folks in the queue.
Okay, just Jeff, to answer, Avery, I think we touched about this originally, and I think our discussion was to focus on the going with the maximum safeguard. So one of the things I think our proposal in which we're in total agreement with PIR is wanting to protect registrants. So we thought this higher safeguard with annual audits would be the safest way to go, but we did recognize some flexibility for relaxing those standards at a future date. And a case in point, if you look at the ICANN proposal, the 5-year financial bond needs to be in place for the first 5 years and is then relaxed. So we would be open to exploring that, again, as long as registrants' interests were protected, though.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I didn't know if that was explored, and that makes total sense to me. Thanks for the answer.
This is Mikey. Richard, if it's okay with you, Christina's got her hand up, and we haven't heard from her before. So can I reverse the order of the queue and let Christina go first? I'm taking the silence as assent. So, Christina, why don't you go?
Sure. Thanks, Richard. I have to say that on a personal intellectual level, I'm very intrigued by the MMA proposal. It just is the one that appeals to me. I just keep coming back to this issue of the proposal is built in large part around the willingness of competition authorities to have some kind of hotline or referral mechanism that is appropriately staffed and that they would be in a position to act within the time frame that we're planning on. And I just think that if we're, this proposal is going to be pursued any farther, that there needs to be, as suggested on the list, some kind of substantive contact with some of these competition authorities to say, is this viable? Because there's no point in setting something up that, as once you try and put it into the real world, isn't going to work.
And the response, Tina, and I got the name right with great effort, Christina, we are looking at that, and the preliminary results that we have uncovered is it is viable and can be implemented. And again, the other thing I would point out here is ICANN's own experts that they paid a lot of money to do proposed a similar referral mechanism to these competition authorities. And again, just one other point that I had raised to some other people off list, if ICANN does not have these established relationships in place with competition authorities, then we have a real big problem with the funnel request, which relies upon that same concept, because if we don't have, if we're not working and don't have that mechanism in place right now to handle issues regarding competition authorities and new requests from 20 GTLDs, how is that going to handle when we scale to 400 new TLDs? So again, we're working on that homework. We recognize that that is a component, and that is we're working on that, Christina.
Okay, one last question, and then we'll change gears. Richard, go ahead. And Michael, could you mute when you're not talking? I think you're the one that's generating a lot of noise on the line. You may be outside or something. Thanks.
Yep.
Yes, so this is Richard. Yeah, I fully agree with Christina's comments. I'd like to see some evidence of that as well. But let's assume, Michael, that, in fact, that mechanism is in place. Given that ICANN, would, per your proposal, would have no involvement in any sort of decision-making, not think of that.
Hang on a minute. Gisela, can you get really aggressive and just mute everybody that's not talking except Richard? We're getting a lot of
noise. Yeah, I'll do that, Mikey.
Thanks. Go ahead, Richard. Try again. No, we muted Richard, too, I guess. Richard, you still there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
There we go.
Okay, great. Yeah, so here's the question. So let's assume for the moment that there is some sort of competition authority referral infrastructure in place to deal with this. Given that ICANN's not involved in that decision, what would be the reason to not allow an applicant to seek that approval before putting their application in? Currently in your proposal, it occurs after the application is submitted. But it seems to me if ICANN's not involved in the decision-making, then the applicant could simply seek that sort of judgment before they submitted their application.
I guess the answer is if an applicant wanted to disclose that information, the string, and answer the questions as to how they intended to market that, we didn't consider this, but I don't think there's anything that we would be opposed to that. Again, all we want to do is make sure that the competition authorities are not looking at who is doing it, but the string in which it's connected, because there is the potential for the string to have some potential competition. So if you wanted to answer the questions that we're talking about and submit that earlier for pre-approval, I right now, off the top of my head, I don't see any objection to that.
Okay, Richard. Aubrey's got her hand up. Go ahead, Aubrey. If we haven't muted you, we may have muted you in the process. You might have to hit star 6 to get back online.
Your line is open, Aubrey.
Sorry, I got lost in mute hell. I wanted to actually ask a clarifying question from Richard, because in Mike's answer, I sort of understood that going public and doing all that, or are you thinking that there's a method by which
you yourself can approach these competition authorities directly, any of the ones that would be relevant to an application, and get some sort of letter that went with your application that said everything was okay. I would think that it would still need to be confirmed, but if such a mechanism or such a thing could be developed, I don't see how it could be a problem, but that's just me talking.
Richard, any follow-up on that? You may be muted, too. Star 6, if you are. You may have muted your phone in addition to Star 6.
Richard, your line is open.
Right, thanks. Yeah. So can you guys hear me?
Yep. Yes, now you're coming through fine.
Yeah, so that's exactly the same. That was exactly the question I was going to ask Mike. So given that the competition authority is the only one, only party making a judgment on the facts, why would the application need to be public in any way? It seems to me that pre-application you could submit a confidential competition authority review with exactly the same information that you're proposing, but it wouldn't need to be public. And then you could have that judgment determined before you submitted your application. By submitting the application, the competition review post-application, you're putting $5,000 of the application fee at risk.
Put it this way, Richard, very valid question, and in the research we're doing, we will add that to our data points to get answers to those questions. But, again, I don't think we see anything that would be a non-starter to that proposal.
Okie dokie. Thank you all.
This is Keith. Sorry, can I jump in there real quick?
Sure, go ahead.
Sorry, just a real quick point. I think, you know, as we talk more about competition authority referral moving forward, it would be very helpful, you know, Mike and Avery and Milton to have a little bit more detail about, you know, which authorities you've contacted, you know, that have been, you know, surveyed, or if it's even a third party that you've consulted with, you know, kind of like a little bit more detail about what, you know, what competition authorities we're talking about and what the feedback really is. Because, you know, obviously you could be talking about a U.S. government agency, could be talking about, you know, an agency or a department from another country, or it could be, you know, many. But I think we need that information.
And as I said, we're working on that, and I think if there is the potential for this to be a viable proposal, if there appears to be some momentum, formally contacting them and trying to get responses is on our list. But again, as Scott, as you would appreciate, a good lawyer always asks, before they ask a question, they always tend to know what the answer is before they ask the question, and that's the homework we're doing right now. Okay?
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Brian,
okay.
You had a question?
I'm going to draw this section to a close. We're running pretty much on schedule. The last chunk of the call, I want to completely switch gears. We've got a group of folks who've stepped forward to basically do staff work for us. I want to clarify what's going on here. We, the working group, are going to be the evaluators of the proposal. However, we need a structure in which to do that evaluation. And so the evaluation team, the gaggle of folks who've stepped forward and anybody else who wants to join them, are not volunteering to review proposals. And if you volunteered with that end in mind, I can save you some work. Rather, what the people on that team have volunteered to do is to collect and draft and develop a series of framing questions, not unlike the kinds of questions that Phil was talking about in his proposal at the top of the call, that we can use as the structure to evaluate the proposals. And so what I want to use this last 15 minutes for is just a brainstorming session to say, to try and flush out the first try at the list of criteria by which we want to evaluate the proposals, and present that as a gift to the evaluation team so that they can get started on their work without having to write in an absolute vacuum. So if you want to have a conversation about the role of the evaluation team, the process stuff, let's do that off list. What I really want to spend the rest of the group time on is what criteria should we use to evaluate our proposal by? And it's just a free-form conversation. We'll just run it through the queue the way we've been doing everything else. We'll use the recording to record all that and carry on. Richard? Richard took his hand down. That was an old hand. So, anybody who's got ideas about the criteria, I like Christina's notion of an analysis team. I'll immediately redraft my mental map to include that because it's a good suggestion. But, you know, what are the criteria? How do we decide? What's the framework we use? Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I have an answer to that, but first I would also suggest, I'm not sure if everyone will agree, that in addition to the proposals, we attempt as best we understand it to include the baseline, the board baseline, or whatever, they didn't call it that, position, so we understand the impact of not coming to closure also.
Yep.
I'll echo the two that I raised in my last intervention. Public interest, as best we can define that and evaluate that, and does the proposal endanger any specific types of GTLDs which possibly could succeed in some other in some other framework, but under this framework might have significant problems.
Great start. Thank you, Alan. Jeffrey, you're next.
Yeah, thanks. I have a concern about what Alan's request is about trying to figure out what the current board resolution states, because I don't think it's up to this working group to define that or to figure it out. If the board comes out or if staff comes out and says this is exactly what the board means, I think the resolution has a good amount of ambiguity in it, and I would hesitate from us trying to define what it is because I think a lot of people have been interpreted different ways. And so that's just my point on us trying to do that work.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think we'll take that one as a separate issue, and let's try now and stay on criteria by which we want to evaluate our proposals. Christina?
I'm very reluctant to say this because I know that this acronym just generates all kinds of generally adverse reactions in ICANN land. Having said that, I wonder if there's some utility in looking at the checklist of questions that the IRT used when we originally proposed our solutions. Obviously, you wouldn't want to use those specific questions, but having kind of a benchmark of what is the harm that's being addressed? Will it scale? Does it accommodate, you know, territorial variations, in this case you would say, to competition law? You know, having just a very general checklist that you can kind of run things through. And we really found that in many cases we rejected a lot of things simply because, you know, we got to canopy gamed and abused, and the answer was a resounding at yes, we couldn't figure out a way around it, so we just jettisoned the solution. Again, it's not going to be a one-for-one match, but it may be a good place to start.
It's a great idea. Let's see. Aubrey's agreeing. Anybody else want to chime in with more criteria? If we're out of gas, that's fine. I was mostly just doing this to give the analysis team sort of a running start. But the concept that Christina is describing is exactly what I had in mind, which is some sort of checklist, some sort of framework that we can use to parse through the various proposals and come to some conclusions. Kathy, go ahead.
I was wondering how others would feel, how you would feel, Mikey. In addition to a set of evaluation criteria, some kind of chart lining up the proposals on different issues that they all have to address, like co-ownership, and where they come out on the different variations of it, just so we can see everything lined up kind of head-to-head.
I love that idea, and in fact, some folks have indicated that they're building such charts for themselves to help with their own analysis. And if you would be willing to share them, especially the rightmost or the left, what I'm dyslexic, left, the leftmost column, which describes the components of the proposals that you're using to compare them. What we've asked Marika to do is build such a chart and parse through the various proposals for a very first draft to build that table and then get that draft back to the proposal developers for them to review it and edit it and make sure that it's not misrepresenting their view. But essentially, that chart plus the evaluation that we're describing is our primary deliverable. And that chart is also going to be really helpful in helping us get to consensus chunk by chunk. We're sort of reaching the end of the phase where we have distinct proposals and need to start homing in on either a consensus view about these various topics or at least, you know, a cluster of views around any given topic. And I think that that chart is the primary deliverable that we're going to be taking snapshots of as we go, and at any given time people can say, ah, that's where they're at. So I love that idea. I saw some hands go up, and then I saw them go down. Any other evaluation criteria ideas that people want to share right now? I'll give it one more round, and then Scott, go ahead.
Okay, I just had one question. With all of the experienced people here on this list, we have registrars and registries now that have been operating under Rule 19, et cetera. Do we have any examples where an audit has been conducted, and if so, the criteria that were applied in those audits? Or if anyone's ever been deaccredited based on an audit?
Anybody? I'm clueless about that. Anybody got any experience?
There were audits conducted in the original from 99 until 2001 in connection with the ComNet.org agreement. So I believe Jeff, actually, if you go to Jeff Newman's proposal, he provides a link to the audit criteria as it appeared in the VeriSign contract, at the registry contract at the time.
Thanks. That was Michael Pelage for the transcript. Good idea. That might be a good piece of spadework for the analysis team to do, just take a look at that. Any other ideas people have? Seems like we're winding down. And I don't want to hold this many people on a call unnecessarily. I'll give it one last look, and then I think we'll call it a day. I thank you all for participating. As always, it was a great conversation. And if anybody's got any process issues, take them up with me off list. And that's it. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Right.